From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made at your doorstep, where a salesperson is trying to convince you to purchase a lawn service or a security system, or thinking back a number of years, a set of encyclopedias. When is the last time you had a salesperson pop by your door? If you haven't seen one in the last 8 to 10 years, that's because, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that profession is dying. Door-to-door sales workers made a recent list of the top 20 dying professions. That list was compiled by Forbes, based on data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. National data shows that more than 158,000 people were employed as door-to-door salespeople in 2010, but about 1 in 5 of those jobs will be gone by 2026 as a result of targeted advertising and more. The Forbes list is one of two that we've seen go viral recently. The second was put together based on data from a new book by John Pugliano called The Robots Are Coming, A Human Survival Guide to Profiting in the Age of Automation. Between the two lists, 29 careers are projected as in decline or dying, and not just because of robot, not just because of robot, not just because... No, I'm a really, really real person, I promise you. But while it may not seem surprising that door-to-door salesperson is listed, do you think lawyer should have been included? What about mortgage broker, broadcaster, financial planner or advisor, IT expert? Come on, we're always going to need IT experts to condescend to us. This hour, we'll talk to professionals whose careers or former careers are on the list, and we'll discuss the future of work in the age of automation. I'd like to welcome our guest. Caitlin Madison is a communications manager at CDS Life Transitions. She's here because she recently changed careers. We'll talk about that in a moment. Yeah. Nice to have you in studio.
I know. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Caitlin is a former intern for WXXI News, and she's been in the news industry, so nice to see her here. Scott Maloof is an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law, who just found out that your own career is in decline, apparently.
Yeah, Evan, can I get a job?
No, mine's on the list too, broadcasters. We're all in danger. Thank you for being back here.
Thanks for having me.
And I actually think your career is quite on the rise, if I can say so myself. James Farley is a financial advisor with Northwestern Mutual. James, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so a lot to talk about here, and as we go throughout the hour, we are going to talk about automation and where it does apply and where it does not apply in this way. But I guess I'll start with Caitlin, because I not only worked with you here when you interned at WXXI News, but in my brief stint as an adjunct professor, you were a standout student in journalism at Nazareth College. And you had a lot to think about when it came to, did you want to pursue a career in television news? Did you want to do that on the production side? Did you want to do that on the on-air side? And now you're doing it on the no side. You've moved around. How much did you think about all of, give me a sense for the considerations you made and finishing an education, thinking about how much that cost you, what's the return on investment, what does it look like, what are the kind of thoughts you had with all that?
So going into college, news was not my plan. I went in as an English lit major, and quickly after I entered my freshman year, I added on a communications and rhetoric double major. And I was thinking I would go into PR, marketing, something like that. But one of the things in the back of my mind was I am the younger sister of someone who works in television. She works on the entertainment side. So she's worked on shows like Saturday Night Live, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. So I had a sister with a cool job. So it was kind of important to me to have a cool job. And it wasn't until I walked into your classroom, so this is all your fault, that I found, I always had an interest in news, but I was never... I never saw a path with news at Nazareth. It was a great college. It was perfect for what I needed those first 2 years, but I didn't see a career in news there. And then I took your class, and it was, I was had this passion that I'd never had about anything before, and it gave me direction. And I said, that's it. I'm going to be a storyteller. I'm going to do the news. And I got my internship here, and within a couple weeks, I said, oh, hey, by the way, I'm transferring to RIT, and I'm going to major in journalism there because they have a journalism program there, which if you're a journalism major at RIT, you're like a unicorn. There were three of us. There's like, we stand out a little bit. So I spent the next 2 years at RIT, a private school, an expensive school, one of the top schools in our country, studying journalism and very strictly journalism. I didn't bring anything else in. I was supposed to stay on just a print track, but I knew I wanted to get into video and television work. Mm-hmm. So I pushed to get into their photojournalism department, and I took a bunch of classes in their photojournalism department. So I had almost a dual major, in a way, in photojournalism and journalism with nothing else there. And my senior year, I ended up getting an internship at 8 the summer before and worked there.
Channel 8, yep.
Yep.
News 8, WROC-TV, yep.
Worked there my entire senior year. And then as soon as I came out, I was brought on as an assignment editor there. And it was, that was the future that I had created. That was what I wanted. I had my foot in the door. Most people, when they go into this industry, they start in the middle of nowhere getting,
you know,
you don't get paid anything. A lot of them work multiple jobs, but I had this foot in the door in a mid-sized market, and I thought, okay, this is it. This is my chance to be exactly what I wanted to be, which was a reporter, with the goal of eventually making my way to Austin, Texas. And over the last 2 years, I started feeling like it's possible that I chose the wrong career. And it wasn't because I hated news, because I adore news. News is the most important thing right now in our culture. And it needs to, we need to be doing good work in news, but I stopped feeling like we were. And so instead of, you know, and it was grinding. It's not a forgiving career, you know? I worked every holiday for the last 2 years. I worked every weekend my senior year. I'd fill in when people were out. And it got to a point where I was done, and I wasn't happy with the stories that I was a part of anymore, which in college I was, because I was picking those stories. I was helping people. And so then I started to say, okay, how can I take this storytelling and impact people's lives and help people in a different way? And out of the blue, I got a phone call from someone who I had worked with that's now at CDS Life Transitions. And she said, hey, would you be interested in, you know, there's a position available. If it's something you're interested in, great. If not, that's fine too. And this was the first time I had an opportunity outside of news. And I looked at it and I saw that, you know what, I could still tell stories and I could still use words to help people in a different way. And that's kind of how I ended up where I am now.
Mm. Oh, there's no doubt you're at a place that's doing important work in the mm-hmm. community, and clearly you feel good about that choice. I want to sort of put an important point on something here, because I know Caitlin decently well. I don't think what you're saying is, when you say, I don't think we were doing the important stories you wanted to do, I don't think you are saying that about anybody individually at ROC,
maybe the
news industry writ large.
The news industry at large and local news. You know, I think that local news is incredibly important. And I think that we're getting caught up in a lot of this, you know, sensationalized news. And
is there an example that stands out to you, the kind of story?
So the things that I was getting tired of and kind of disappointed in were, you know, we're going to the car crashes, we're going to the fires, and we're placing certain emphasis on one population and not the other population. Mm-hmm. And why are we doing that? You know, and I wasn't really getting an answer. It's just kind of the trend of the way things are going. You know, if as a medium-sized local news market, we're competitors with one another, and you kind of got to be doing what the other stations are doing, or else the audience is like, well, why don't you have that? And it was getting frustrating to me because I had turned stories in college that had an impact on people and had changed people's lives. And that was what hooked me. That was what did it for me. But I wasn't seeing every day that we were changing people's lives in a positive way. And again, that's not just one station. That's local news right now. That's kind of news as a whole right now.
All right. That's fair enough. And so now your view is sort of a values choice. Was it also, and you don't have to go deep on mm-hmm. this, but was it also financial?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was fresh out of college, and I was making they don't tell you in college what you're going to make. No one breaks down and says, here's what you're going to make hourly. Or
well,
here's
what. Well, they should.
They should. Or they should, you know, sometimes it was brought up jokingly, but no one ever tells you. And I was even under the impression, you know, when I was working part time, people kept saying that they were poor, but they didn't. I was like, okay, well, what are we talking? Like, no one would tell me what they were making. And it wasn't until I was full time getting paid regularly. And I was last year I was part time and half the year I was full time, and I did not make $20,000 last year. And at 26 years old, when you have to pay bills and you have to pay your own insurance, you can't do that at some point. So you have to make the decision. Is it more important to me to have the cool job, or is it more important to me to have the cool life? And I chose the cool life.
Okay, fair enough. Caitlin Madison is now communications manager at CDS Life Transitions. And so let me kind of take a quick look at what these lists are telling us about dying jobs. I certainly hope broadcasting, and broadcasting is a big, broad category here. I mean, it doesn't just mean television news. And to Caitlin's point, it's important. Local journalism is important. You hear that here all the time. Not just and that's not just NPR, and that's not just WXXI. But looking at the list here, there are a number on the two lists, Forbes and this other stranger list from John Pugliano's book, The Robots Are Coming. There's a couple there's a bunch that kind of land on both of them. Floral designers, that's on both lists. Though again, I'm a big fan of floral designers. Postal workers is on both lists. Big fan of the mail. Data entry clerks, telephone switchboard operators, farmers and ranchers. I don't get this, but let me read from their list. The number of agricultural workers is expected to decline 8% from 2010 levels by 2020, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's not because people are eating less, but because farmers are getting more efficient. Aha. Replacing workers with machinery and getting bigger yields out of smaller plots of land. So again, automation. Fast food cook is on there. Yes, newspaper reporter is on there. Sorry, everyone. Textile machine workers, door-to-door sales is on there. Those are some of the ones that are on both lists, though I'm surprised, I admit, that there's some that wasn't on both lists that I thought should be, like travel agent. I'm surprised that wasn't. So there's a number. But let me ask, let me turn to James Farley, who is a financial advisor. Yours is on one of the two lists there, financial advising. I was a little surprised at that one, too. Are you? What do you think?
I'm definitely surprised. I think it's somewhat absurd. But
especially, defend it. Here we go.
Well, I mean, whenever you're dealing with something that requires a lot of specialization, there should be experts involved. And so I think that there's been a lot of publication around the do-it-yourself mantra or just buying the market and indexes and things like that. But I don't think, if that's what you're going to an advisor for, then that's not really what their role should be. I mean, a true planner or advisor should be getting to know who that person is as an individual or their family or their business, what the vision is that they're trying to create, and helping solve problems across the board. It's beyond investments or insurance planning. It's also poking holes on their behaviors, the way that they make decisions, helping them avoid major catastrophic things that could impact them. And so I think it's rare that I ever sit down with someone and they just come in the door to buy things. I mean, does that happen? Sure. But most of the time it's taking a bigger picture view on what school they want to send their kids to or what their vision of retirement is. And we're looking at, is it a good idea for them to refinance their house or not? I'm not a loan officer or mortgage broker, but they should consult with someone about that if I'm seeing a high interest rate that they might not have talked to their neighbor
about. Well, funny enough, mortgage broker's on the list too, man.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe there's no one for them to consult with.
So I think especially in areas where, you know, law, accounting, financial planning, these are worlds that change dramatically and drastically all the time based on new laws that go into effect, based on whoever might be in Congress at that time and what their views are on taxes. And so could you do everything on your own and save enough to get to where you want to go? Potentially, yes, absolutely. But was it the most efficient way to get there? Did you manage risk appropriately? Were the proper protections in place? And what's the taxation on the back end?
So I want to throw at you, as a financial advisor yourself, I want to throw at you the most uncharitable description of your work, and then I want to give a charitable counterpoint as I see it.
Sure.
And we'll take your point of it. The uncharitable description is that many of your colleagues, you know, could throw darts just as well as you can think through what you want to choose and how to structure investments, et cetera. That it is a lot of luck. The charitable is, even if that's true, and I'm not sure I agree that that's true, but even if that's true, do I want to actually do the work of managing it and doing that work myself? And do I want someone like you who can at least do the work, the legwork, the setup, the structuring, et cetera, mm-hmm. if I'm lucky enough to be in a position to have money to save? So even if the first part's true, I think the second part keeps you around. And now you're going to tell me why the first part's not true.
Well, I think the big takeaway is you're not going to a financial advisor just for portfolio construction and picking the best possible funds. Because if I'm going to be hired based on my most recent returns versus someone else, there's always going to be someone that's going to steal that business. That's not why you hire someone or work with them. You want the highest probability of success. Returns are very important, but there is a degree of luck there, right? At the same time, there's historical studies like modern portfolio theory that's been around since 1934 that states for any level of risk, there's a maximum return. And so we're always trying to figure out, what's that behavior again? What comfort level do you have? And how do we minimize that risk to get that same number? Because somebody else might build a portfolio that gets you the same return. But if I'm taking 30% less risk to get there, there's value there. Morningstar has done multiple studies on the value of financial advisors and how bad people are as investors. Just Google investment return versus investor return. They are dramatically different. And I think one of the biggest values that advisors bring is that behavioral economics coaching. Because if you look, I actually printed out a study that was done in the Wall Street Journal for Morningstar. The best performing mutual fund from 2000 to 2010, if you chose the right fund and were invested the whole time, was this fund called CGM Focus. I'm not even sure if it's still around. It returned 18% annually, which is insane, yeah, during two recessions. The average return of an actual investor that held it was negative 11%. That's a crazy swing. So how did I own something that was fantastic, but I got negative returns at the same time? And it's because people do the opposite of what an investor does. An investor sees something go down and they want to buy it because that's a good value for its return. An individual sees something go up 50% and jumps onto the buy train when it's already at its high and then sells when the uncomfortable thing happens and it's at a low. So I think there's a lot of reason to, again, work with credentialed professionals that take planning as a priority. If your focus is, I want to buy the fastest driving car, the best hot rod mutual fund, that's not really what I'm here to do, nor any true planner should do. But if that's the pitch you're hearing, just please run away.
I think that's a really good defense of your profession. I really do. I think that's a really forthright defense of the profession. That's James Farley, who is a financial advisor with Northwestern Mutual. His profession is on one of these two lists. And the world is listicles, by the way. We know it. But it's one of these two viral lists of jobs that are dying or in danger. Did you go to school, or what was your training for this? Did you always think that this would be your life?
Mine was significantly non-traditional. I did not go to college the routine way. I started at a startup company when I was 19 years old, three people that we built up to like 110 individuals doing about 20 million. Great industry. It was a seminar business where we coached and trained people in real estate, mortgage, and financial planning. I had owners.
That sounds so boring.
It was actually a
really
lot of fun.
But really lucrative.
It was a lot of fun. And it was very lucrative.
Hold on. It couldn't have been fun, though.
Oh, I enjoyed everything about it.
You were a different cat, man. That's good.
A lot of it was conditioning on the way the mind works and helping reprogram.
Oh, actually, you know, that is interesting.
So it was empowerment and visualization and training and coaching and things like that. The negative was owners decided to keep up with the Joneses and got some really bad financial habits. And so when some of the industries we dealt with tanked, overhead was too high, and I had owners pulling out hundreds of thousands a week for their lifestyle or gambling habits.
Oh boy.
So the company failed and I had to restart my life, you know, at 28 years old, trying to figure out what I wanted the rest of my life to look like. So I vowed to A, never work for someone again and have their ability to control my destiny be a concern. And I thought at the same time, if I can take the knowledge that I've obtained over the years to get into profession to help business owners or help families and help individuals to stop from making defeating decisions, to put them in a place where they can retire, they can send their kid to school, they can sleep at night, then that's something I wanted to do.
Really interesting stuff.
So, Evan, if
yeah, I Scott Maloof.
You know, I'm chomping at the bit here. Just Caitlin and James brought up really good points, which is I think these lists are very focused on the wrong thing. They're focused on that end product. You know, in MySpace, you know, if you went to a lawyer, I want a will. Whereas the first thing the lawyer is going to say is, well, wait a minute, what's your family structure? What are you really trying to do here? What are your last wishes? You know, and I think the technology really promotes getting that thing versus solving the problems that, you know, both came.
That's such a good way to describe it.
Yeah. And let me give you an example. I call it the triple Whopper problem. So you go to a Burger King and they've got the screen and it lets you customize your Whopper any way you want. So the other day I was there and I said, all right, I'm going to get a triple Whopper. I'm going to take all the meat out of it. You know, and the screen totally let me do that.
What?
Yeah, it let me order a triple Whopper, no patties, right? Whereas if I'd done it with a human, they would have said, what are you doing? You know, we're not, I'm not going to place that order for you. And that's what I think is really common with technology. It will let me engage in the transaction, whereas the human will say, what are you really trying to do here?
Okay, so wait. Are you voting for the triple Whopper as an, that's actually solving your problem in a good way?
No, it's not solving my problem. I just want lunch. And the human would have said, okay, you want no meat. Let's go with the salad. Let's go with the 50 other options versus the screen that said, you want a triple Whopper with no meat, no patties? Sure, I'll give you that.
But it sounds like that is what you wanted, no?
No, but should I really want that? If I want, why
that's
am I,
a fair question.
Why am I paying?
I'm going to say no.
Right. Why am I paying, you know, paying three times the price for something that does not have the content?
Because James Farley is not advising you financially. You're making
right.
a bad decision.
James would have said, let me buy you lunch and let's walk away, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But no, I actually think that your point there is really good one, Scott, because in a moment, what I want to do is ask all of our panelists how much they have ever thought about whether automation could impact their own livelihoods. Because now we're in a world where eventually that's going to impact a lot of people. Not everybody, but a lot of people. But for you as an attorney, I was surprised to see attorneys on this list. And you were kind of cautioning me coming in the door today that there's some thought that some legal profession, not all of it, but aspects of it could be endangered mildly.
Right. I mean, where we currently are is there are models that compete with going and sitting down with your local attorney. So, for example, you have certain sites that will let you form your own corporation. You just download the forms and then it says, okay, here's how you file it. You know, that's out there. And then going further in the future, you know, we have more and more technology being applied. So currently in the field of computers, right? Let's say XXI gets sued and we find there are, you know, 50 computers here. There's technology that will help to sort and slice and dice that the 50,000 documents without any human eyes looking at it. That currently exists. But the challenge comes in is saying, why are we doing that? You know, you do that, you get the 50,000, and then there's the IT guy who says, oh, you know, I got a closet full of other technology that the computer can't sort, you know? And that's where the real lawyering value comes in is to say, well, what the heck is in the closet, right? Maybe that's the smoking gun. Maybe that's nothing, but do we really want to pay to look at it? So that's our real challenge is to know the technologies are out there, but then augment them ourselves. I think both of you, Caitlin and James, would say the same thing. Like, we're creatives, we're trying to help people, we're looking at it, and we're using it and properly interpreting it for you, as opposed to that. If we had a realtor here, they would probably give us an earful about Zillow and why it's good or bad.
Hmm. Well, let me read an email from a listener named Alex, and I'll tell our audience, I've got some emails from you on the subject of dying jobs or professions, and whether you agree or disagree with these various items on the list here. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. By the way, did you really order that triple Whopper with no meat?
No, I thought, that what a foolish way to spend my money. James, was that the right choice?
Walking away was the good decision,
yes. That was, man. Okay, Alex says, it seems like the silver bullet for many of the dying professions of these lists is simply automation. How do you feel we should prepare for the automation of a significant amount of the job market? That's from Alex. And I think you all have different insights, but I want to start with you, Scott, because when you raise, I think you are raising kind of, I don't know if it's a values concern, but it's our lives are going to change when we get more automation because we will have less of that interaction to figure out how. So the Whopper example is a really good example, but there's a lot more out there that, yes, automation could get certain things done, but are we really going to get it done the way we want? Is it going to be efficient? Is it going to really conform to our needs? Is it going to be clumsy? And I do worry about that. I mean, I think that's probably a future that we're headed towards.
That's right. And also, I was thinking about it as we came here. So let me take my example as lawyers. So we've got the rules of ethics that guide everything we do. One of the rules being, okay, your fees have to be reasonable. And this is where Evan inserts the chuckle and says, oh, that's impossible.
No. No, it's okay. You work hard too. I don't like the fact that you bill me when you're eating a triple Whopper while you're driving, just because you thought about me. But go ahead.
So we have rules that are imposed on us and by the states. Every state has them. Whereas if you're getting your divorce from California or someplace else, those rules are going to be harder to apply because maybe it's not a lawyer giving you those. So, you know, you're not getting those protections. And I think implicitly, a lot of these services don't give you the protections that having a person there would, that the local rules would. And secondly, where's the there there? So let's say, you know, we've talked about Facebook, we've talked about these other services. When they go down, you know, you and I are not going to Facebook's offices in California. Whereas if you're working with a local person, you know, if Caitlin or James does something and I'm their client and I don't like it, I can go to their office. I can call them. And that's the second problem with these services, where when you automate everything, you know, part of it is driving down. They cannot afford, by the very nature of the business model, to talk to people because then it destroys the model. And there's a cost there, and we have to factor that in.
Is there a way to mitigate that concern?
Well, I think like anything else, you have the person using it. You know, Caitlin or James will be the person who uses the automated tools that creates the photo, that manipulates the photo, that does the financial analysis. And then they will say, here is what I see. For me as a lawyer, I'm going to use the technology to analyze the documents and then say, maybe we do look in the closet with all those things because they do all point back to old files. Or maybe we don't, and here's how it's defensible.
Hmm. All right, James, how do you view this question on automation in the future and whether that, I guess what the impacts are, because we know some of it's coming.
Yeah.
And some of it is sort of preventable. But how do you see that?
Well, I think you have to embrace it, really. I mean, in our profession, it's getting easier to serve people because we can allow certain computer systems to do the trading or the rebalancing or things like that and keep the costs as low as possible to assist the client. So I think it allows me nothing more than the ability to think more strategically through the problems and bring new ideas to the table rather than focusing on the minutiae of what I do, which is really, really valuable. And to Scott's point, I mean, we're fiduciaries, right? We have a legal obligation to do what's in the best interest of our clients at all times. If you're purchasing an LLC on LegalZoom, I can give you a myriad of reasons why that's a bad idea, but B, who's that fiduciary, right? Like, who are you going to hold accountable for it wasn't even the right sort of organization to form based on your specific needs? You know, you want to solicit 100 investors and you should have been a C Corp or something. So, right. So there's a lot of things that just saying, well, I'm going, again, it comes down to what kind of experience, I think, is what you're looking for. Do you want to have 100% of the responsibility on yourself for making a decision and you know, view nobody else as an expert in that field? Or do you value someone else's opinion that studies this all the time? And, you know, that's really where that's going to come down to.
Yeah, James is talking about efficiency in your own line of work. Mm-hmm. The amazing thing is, as we see automation unfolding in so many different industries, we can't get that going for doctors who still spend so much time filling out paperwork and can't get as much face time with patients. Boy, healthcare is a mess. Caitlin, how do you see this sort of impacting? And how much did you have to think about that as a student?
Yeah. So as a student, I think that a lot of our curriculum was very stuck in, you know, the traditional journalist, the idea of the traditional journalist. But I think that was a problem because journalism isn't dying. Broadcast isn't dying. It's changing. And we need to be able to adapt to that and use these tools that are there to help us. That said, I think when we bring this technology into news and into communications of any form, it's incredibly dangerous because the job of storytellers, the job of people in news, the job of journalists is to question why there's no meat on your double Whopper. That's our job. And when you lose that question in news, you're in trouble because, you know, that's where our foundation is built on. So if we have machines taking over, that's going to be an issue.
And there are machines that literally write stories based on press releases now.
Yep.
I mean, there's algorithms that will do it.
Yep.
And let's just add in, you know, someone who wrote the press release knows that. They're optimizing the press release for the machine.
Yeah, that's a great point, too.
Same thing. Like you hear people talk about LinkedIn. Okay, go optimize your profile. Well, you know, just because you have certain keywords doesn't mean you're a good fit for the job. And we're losing a lot of this is also losing the human aspect, where the person has the skepticism, like you've talked about journalists. We really want that journalist who says, you know, I've read 100 of these reports, and I don't think something's not right here, and has the ability to go do that. If we outsource everything, we automate everything, you'll lose that human intuition.
Yeah, and you're raising a bit of a frightening point, Caitlin. Mm-hmm. It's true. On the subject of automation, though, Rich in Rochester wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hi, Evan. This is a good discussion. On the subject of automation, I think to one of your guests who made the point that automation is there to leverage and to do higher levels, to do the higher level work, to get rid of the mundane stuff. There is the danger of devaluing. I look at things like mechanical engineers and stuff because of programs like AutoCAD and the like, because I'm in the technical field. It has devalued them. And so there's a lot of concerns, but what was just jarred in my mind when the last guest spoke, when she spoke of, you know, all these templates being used to write different types of headlines and stuff. Also, AI is a problem because AI is written by, say, for the, you know, like most of the people in AI, say, are white males. And so all of the AI out there is written to their liking and to the way they see the world. And there's got to be a way of putting in all this software, especially AI, the myriads of thinking and the myriads of diversity that we have in our country, are we going to lose that? That's, I think, a bigger danger, is that we're going to lose ways of thinking because AI is written by this certain group of people who do all the AI. So all of the outcomes are going to always be to their preferences.
Now, Rich, I'm with you on these concerns, but the board that I'm looking at, and it's not automated, it was typed in by producer Megan Mack, indicated that you had some optimism, or at least a kind of a difference.
Yes, I do.
You're getting there, I know.
Well, you know, when you're sitting here and you're listening, you hear all these things that come at you, and it's like,
I'm with you.
But yeah, to the point of the optimism, I am. I like the artist or the person who's writing the document, all of a sudden, they can write the document 15, 20, 30 times, and so now they can do it better. I think you can get rid of, you can become so much better at what you do by leveraging that stuff and getting rid of the mundane stuff and learning how to use the templates. But within using those templates, now you use your creativity because it's being released, because now you're not doing the mundane work. So there's a lot of good in it. But, you know, so that's the way you have to approach it. You're going to have to always approach it now. How do I leverage all of this technology that has released me from sitting down and writing 1+1? I don't have to write 1+1 anymore. I don't have to do parentheses anymore if I'm an accountant. So as an accountant, now that I don't have to do this, now I can start doing more forensic work in my accounting, my everyday accounting work, and seeing what's really going on. And the same thing for the lawyer who did, now everything is being indexed. All of the law books are being indexed. The searches are clean. And now he has to look and he has to analyze those searches and say, what's the best fit? So I think there's a huge amount of upside to this, you know, also. Like, there are the concerns, but the upside, I think, is really there.
Yeah, Rich,
if you're willing to take it.
I appreciate that, okay. And thanks for the phone call. That's largely the point that James was making, and that is the sunny side of automation, mm-hmm. that there may be jobs that are dying, but for the jobs that are there, you can get more efficient, get more creative, have more time, hopefully interface with real people or do what you want to do. So do you generally share Rich's optimism?
I absolutely do. So, like I said, I think it brings you the opportunity to hear more stories, to help more people, and to suit to their particular needs, because you're not worried about the minutiae of it. You can problem solve. You can take your knowledge and expertise and put it to work. You know, just because TurboTax exists doesn't mean I don't need a CPA, right? So there's automations for if I want to do things myself, but if I want to seek out changes that have occurred with the tax plan and how that affects me, and with the withholding tables changing recently, am I going to owe taxes next year? I probably want to consult with someone human rather than go online. and do those things.
And, you know, and that's a good example where when you read the tax code, and I advise everyone listening not to do that, you know, there are people who literally are parsing every single word and saying, what does that mean? And how do we build it? And you can't reduce that to automation when it's brand new. And, you know, as we see here in New York, where the state government is trying to say, okay, how do we preserve, you know, state and local tax deductions? So I think we can't overestimate that. I just want to throw out two other real quick things, which is one, privacy. You know, as more services go online, become automated, we lose privacy. And the example I give is Spotify did a marketing campaign a few years ago where they were talking about people's playlists, and they were asking, I think there was one where they said, hey, to that person who played that same sad song 27 times, what's going on? You know, that wouldn't have happened with a human. No business person around this table would have said, I'm going to, you know, take my client's private stuff and use it as a marketing campaign. But when you go online, that does happen. And the second part I would just throw out is, you know, one of my lawyer friends talks about the automation tools, and they say, you know what, in 10 years, we're all going to file the same brief, either side of the case, you know. And the challenge becomes, where's the creativity? Where's the thinking? You know, we have seen a sea change in same-sex marriage in this country. Well, that took people sitting down and saying, I'm going to make a new argument that hasn't been accepted, but I'm going to do it again and again. Whereas if you'd looked at that algorithmically, you might have said, we're not going to make that argument because no court historically has bought it. Why would I make this anew? So I think we've got to really be careful about applying these technologies and saying, what's going to really happen as they get used? And are we going to lose creativity? Are we going to lose privacy?
Yeah, I mean, this whole conversation is about understanding where that efficiency will benefit us and where we lose the nuance, and there, whether you're ordering a sandwich or you're talking about briefs and the possible impacts, or you're talking about press releases and that become news stories. We better be having these conversations, I think. So as we talk about dying jobs, that's an unexpected but a big focus of this has been that so far this hour. I'm going to get back to your emails in just a second. I'm way late for our only break of the hour. We'll come back to your emails because I've got some emails from listeners who want to contribute to the jobs they fear are dying or changing with technology. Scott Maloof is in studio, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. Caitlin Madison, communications manager at CDS Life Transitions, and James Farley, a financial advisor with Northwestern Mutual. Right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, understanding U.S.-Mexico relations, especially in regards to the criminal landscape, violence, gangs, MS-13, and more. There's been a lot of hot rhetoric from the White House and President Trump regarding MS-13, the danger that he says Americans are in. What is the reality? The World Affairs Council of Rochester has brought in an expert guest, and he joins us next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Dave writes to us from Pittsburgh to say, over the next 20 to 30 years, auto mechanics, as we know them today, will become rare. Electric vehicles do not have most of the parts that current fossil fuel cars have that require maintenance. For example, no ignition systems, exhaust systems, and all the stuff associated with limiting pollution, like mass airflow sensors, oxygen sensors, and so on. Because the service facility is the major profit center of auto dealers, the whole business model of automobile sales will change. That's from David. I haven't thought about that, and as someone who apparently needs a new catalytic converter on my car, David, I'm wishing I had an electric vehicle. I imagine their electric vehicle maintenance is needed, just different, but maybe less frequent and less profitable is what David's saying. So that's interesting. And on Twitter, this is Kate, who says, I was a kitchen designer for 33 years. So many people thought the project should be done in record time and under budget. I blame HGTV. Not automation, but HGTV. I know plenty of people in forensics who blame CSI for the fact that even some police officers today think that the forensic analyst goes to the crime scene, makes the arrest, does all the superhero work, you know, catches the person in the back alley and puts the whole thing to bed in roughly 24 hours. So it's television does impact the way we perceive the world. Let me ask all of our guests, if you had a child or a younger sibling, what is the profession that maybe when you were growing up you would have thought that's a good way to go, but now you would say, do not. That is going to be gone, or that is a bad, that does not seem to be a wise career choice. Is there something that stands out to you, Scott?
Well, I would have said elevator operator, but that makes me sound like I'm 110 years old.
Yes.
You know, let me just take that a little counterintuitively and just say, there's a lot of computer programmers who use old languages, languages that are not popular right now, but there's tons of legacy systems out there. So what I'd really say is, instead of looking at these articles that say, oh, here's the prognostication about the Department of Labor, really look at people in the industry and say, what can you, you know, what are you doing? So let's take architects. Architects would probably say, yeah, design software has changed our business, but the idea of walking into a site in the middle of a city that has a lot of design challenges, I can do a bunch of things that nobody else can do, like the sight lines, like the shadows, you know. So I'd say talk to the experts in that particular industry and really get why they do what they do.
Yeah, architect, by the way, routine architect is on the list of dying jobs because, the author writes, a lot of the services architects provide can be provided by people who do not have licenses. And my response to that is, like what? But I guess what you're saying is, you know, some of the basic...
Well, like design build. You're thinking an engineer who may say, okay, here's some existing plans we've had. You know, we can put up your warehouse, you know, in the middle of virgin ground, versus an architect with a plot in the middle of a city who says, well, we've got a whole bunch of different competing things like foot traffic, shadows, things like that. So that's kind of, and again, a lot of these are apples and oranges. I think one of the, you know, when we go back to the car thing, you know, if we talk to all the auto dealer, you know, the folks who run the dealerships, they would say, you know what, we're really thinking about mobility. We may be managing a fleet of 200 cars that go out in the morning, take people to work, come back in, we service them, and folks just pay us a monthly fee instead of coming in every 5 years and buying it. And then we're going to need a whole different fleet of technicians and maybe computer folks.
I suppose when I think about architecture, you're right that some of the design work could be done technologically, but you're right. Then you end up having a situation where you go, you put that next to dinosaur barbecue? Caitlin Madison, what about you? What stands out that you would tell people do not?
I don't know that I would discourage any specific career. I think I would encourage someone to say, you know, look at the career and are you able to build the life that you want out of this? Or is it just a career? And I don't think I would discourage anyone from becoming an expert in any field, because from a journalist's perspective, I can't walk up to a machine and ask its opinion or its expertise on something. I need those expert sources in order to do my job. And we need those people to continue to be around. We can't, you know, if all that's left is journalists and machines, we're in a bad place.
Well, I also wonder, as you talk about, you know, think about what you want to do, what you want to contribute, the life you want to build. Do you now think that whether it's people your age, mid, late 20s, whether it's people in their teens now thinking about work, are you expecting to have to change careers 3 to 4 to 5 times before you are retirement age?
Yep.
You do?
Absolutely. Yeah. My parents, my mom's a nurse. She's been a nurse for 30 years now. Growing up, my father was a dentist and still is. It's not the same anymore. You know, my sister even, who had the cool job, worked in television, is looking to get out. And she's now 36 years old. And, you know, she went to school for a very specialized career. And so she's, you know, it's kind of a struggle to, you know, find something else when you are so specialized. So I think that's something to consider, you know. So when I was in the photojournalism class, we took a trip to New York City. And one of the places we visited was the New York Times, where we spoke with one of their photo editors. And he went around the room and asked what we were majoring in. And for most of us, it was just journalism. But for me, it was journalism on top of journalism. And he said, well, so you can't do anything else. And there was some truth to what he was saying, because I didn't have, you know, arts to back it up. I didn't have history. I didn't have, you know, I had dropped that English lit when I transferred over. So, you know, it's about when you go into school, creating a well-rounded individual and not just someone specialized, because then you kind of pigeonhole yourself. And we do live in a time where at some point you may get laid off. Your company may go down. You're going to have to change your life, basically, and you need to be prepared to do that.
Yeah, and let me just channel a recent conversation and bring a little data into it. We had Lyman Stone, who does a lot of research and data analysis on the program, who wrote a piece for Vox about millennial job habits, and to our surprise pointed out that no, millennials are not jumping from job to job as much as even previous generations. They're actually rooting into jobs longer, but the reason being, millennials often express fear that if I leave this job, I'm in trouble. I have to keep this job. There aren't other jobs. So millennials express, when you when you do broad-based surveys, a desire or a willingness or an expectation that they will go from job to job or have multiple careers. But right now, they're rooting in out of fear that there might not be something around the corner next for us.
And
that dynamic
was,
feel pretty
that
right
That was
to you?
Part of, you know, when I was considering leaving news, I wondered, what am I capable of doing besides this? Because I knew that I was so specialized. But I did have an ability to, you know, use words, and I had connections, and I knew people, and that's part of it. That's, you know, absolutely build your networks. But yeah, no, I that was a concern that I had, and I think that, you know, we all lack a little bit of job security right now.
Yeah. And so CDS Life Transitions, is it for a while for you?
I think it might be it for a while.
They're very lucky.
Yes.
Let me just interject really quickly that, you know, when I started practicing social media law, people are like, what's that? And now that question never comes up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, people have seen again and again daily, it comes into the news. And so I think, you know, Caitlin had implied learning how to learn, knowing those are the really core skills, because when you're hit, you know, your second, third career, whatever job you have, no one was going to have trained you for it. You may need the underlying skills, the programming, the law, the architecture, the financial management, but that exact job, you would not have been able to learn about it in college. That's just the reality. So I think when people get really fixated on, you know, like the guy who said you can only do one thing, that's not right. And that's not – when you talk to every single person, they say, well, I took this job because somebody brought me to the city and we're not together anymore and now I've had three million changes, you know. So that's
but
more
I,
the reality.
But I think what I'm hearing from Caitlin too, though, is this – that moment where you go, ugh, is my education too narrow? Do I need to have – a broad menu of options career-wise. But, I mean, I take the point. So
yeah, then you're an expert in nothing.
Absolutely.
Jack of all trades, master of all trades is the goal. What would you tell a younger sibling, a child, somebody who's looking at this saying, you know, this career seems cool?
So I think it kind of comes down to expectations and what you think it might look like. So for me, the answer would probably be law. And it's not because it's not an exceptional place to be, because some of my best friends are lawyers and I'm on the phone with them all the time. I study it all the time. But when I was younger, my thought of what an attorney would be like is you go to a firm and you do cases all day and you get paid six figures and just business comes to you. And that's not the way that it works at all. Most people... if you're going to be truly successful in that world, they specialize in very specific niches like you do. And you know, trusts and estates or business law specific, and they get entrenched in that. So I think if your expectation is I'm going to go work for someone and get paid a boatload of money because of my knowledge in law, I would suggest that that's probably not the case if you're willing to hone your skill sets and be a business owner or go out there and bring in business, then that is different. But, you know, to some of the points earlier, I think you're not a product of your degree being who you are as a person. So, you know, I come from the School of Hard Knocks. I have a lot of diplomas, but at the same time, I have a willingness to learn and I want to constantly improve. And I think that, you know, engaging in that skill set of learning as well as just engaging with people and pulling from their experience can bring a lot to the table.
And James, by the way, if I could just make a suggestion, if this whole financial advisement doesn't work out, which I think it's going just fine, you've got the kind of voice that you could put in a bottle and pour over pancakes. So maybe broadcasting is a fit for you.
All right. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, we've had a number of listeners comment on James's voice. There's a host here, you know, don't offend the host. We're almost out of time here. And I want to ask one last question on which is how this question of dying professions either drives the gig economy. So producer Megan Mack and I were having a conversation about this and she kind of brought up the question that, do you think the gig economy is a result of dying professions? In other words, needing to cobble together different things or a fear of that? Or is that kind of a stretch here? I mean, when we talk again, gig economy, we're talking about sort of cobbling together incomes from different things that are not necessarily full-time. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think at the end of the day, the gig economy exists because the technology exists and folks are going to have multiple gigs. You see people all the time who have a side gig. I drive an Uber or I sell stuff on Etsy. So that's just reality. But I would say if you think about this side gig and how do I morph it into a full-time gig or a full-time business, that's a good thing to do because you keep it in your pocket as, okay, if things go really well, I can leave.
Yeah. Caitlin, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think the technology's there, so it makes it easier. It's not the same as having to work, you know, three jobs at one time, three full-time jobs, you know, it allows you to create passive streams of income. So you can kind of, in certain, you know, instances, set it and forget it. And I think that's beneficial. And I think in certain instances, it's becoming necessary.
Yeah.
Because it's expensive to live. And you can't always live off yeah. just, you know, one job. So you have to figure out what works. And I think the technology being there helps make it work for more people.
20 seconds. What do you think about the gig?
There could also be just a lack of fulfillment in what they're doing full time. So
that's another good point.
That could also be a reason or indicator for that.
That's a great point. Lauren writes to us on Twitter and says, regarding her experience, it's not having to change careers for millennials, but wanting to. Moving around, testing the waters. She says, rarely have I met a 20-something who wants to be a lifer in anything. So, interesting insights this hour as we talk about ostensibly dying professions, what it means, connections to automation, and more. Our thanks to James Farley, a financial advisor. You'll find him at Northwestern Mutual. Great having you. Thanks for being here,
Thank
James.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Caitlin Madison, now communications manager at CDS Life Transition. Say hello to the folks over there. Thanks for coming in.
I will. Thank you.
And our thanks to Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and law, and apparently a polymath who can talk about anything. Thank you.
What can I say to that? Thanks, Evan.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Short break. More connections coming up.